Colin, welcome to the show. I've been, you know, I get excited about having guests on, but I'm really excited about this one. You have such a breadth of knowledge and experience over the past decades. So what's up? Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Jason. It's a privilege.
And what I mean by breadth of knowledge is like you've been all over the place. And, you know, doing my little quasi research for the show, it's like, you know, captive by Somali pirates, landmine initiatives, Ukraine, writing about the band Pussy Riot. I mean, it's just a different spectrum of skill. And let's take it back. How did you get into this world of world-class travel, investigative journalism, and just taking that step?
Well, I've been lucky enough for most of the last 20 years to have worked for a newspaper in the UK called the Daily Telegraph. And for part of that time, I was based in Iraq as a freelancer just after the fall of Saddam Hussein. So was there for 2 years. During that time, that was when I started working for the Telegraph. I'd previously worked on the London Evening Standard, which is kind of like the New York Post or something, London's equivalent of that, for about 4 or 5 years. I got kind of bored of that, so I went to Iraq for a bit of excitement, basically, to be honest.
What year were you in Iraq?
Hmm?
What years were you over there?
I got there, I went there to cover the invasion. Well, that was the plan anyway. It proved harder to logistically than I thought. So I ended up getting there on the day the war ended. Literally within hours of my arriving in Baghdad, George Bush declared major hostilities over. So I was in what classed as a war zone technically, I think for sort of 3 or 4 hours. Yeah. Just enough time to get a beer before sundown, I think. And so it wasn't a terribly promising start to my career as a kind of gritty foreign correspondent covering wars and so on. Although, as it turned out, it wasn't a bad move because, as we now know, the invasion of Iraq, the operation that toppled Saddam Hussein, went pretty much like clockwork, quicker, in fact, than people expected. It was the bit afterwards that didn't kind of go quite according to plan. And so from a journalistic point of view, that was a good time to be there. So I was based there for a couple of years. It was an interesting time. It began to get pretty dangerous towards the end with kidnappings and so on of foreigners. Several journalists I knew were abducted for periods of time. And then as a result of being a stringer, like a kind of part-time Baghdad-based freelance correspondent for the Sunday Telegraph, they took me on in their London office as a London-based foreign correspondent, where you basically traveled around the world covering whatever stories broke here and there. And that's how I've been lucky enough to travel to so many places, whether it's back to the Middle East, Somalia, where I was kidnapped back in 2008, West Africa, Eastern Europe, and most recently, Ukraine. I'm now freelance for the Telegraph. I'm not staff anymore, but essentially I've been doing that kind of job for the best part of 20 years now, which is it's been a great experience. I'm very lucky, really, to have that opportunity.
Yeah, when you bring up Iraq, I was there in 06, so I was probably almost quasi the same. I gotta stop using that word quasi, but around the same time frame when it was getting really heated over there, a lot of direct action from our forces, a lot of different groups popping up. I think about journalists out there, you know, when the US goes outside the wire, you know, they bring a convoy, they bring a bunch of people. Now, when I think about journalists, I'm like, you might be out there with a translator, maybe a guide. That's got to take a lot of, I don't know what it is. Is it courage or is it like just you got to jump into it? Or what is that like to go outside the wire?
Yeah, it was a difficult period that I was there till the... I was based there permanently until the spring of 2005, and already it was getting dangerous. Contrary to what most people think, the journalists were not based in the green zone or the international zone in Baghdad. They all lived out in hotels, and there was a lot of kidnap gangs crawling around in those days, trying to kidnap journalists or basically any foreigner they could lay their hands on. by that time, there were hardly any foreigners around anyway. So you stood out like a billiard ball, frankly. I pulled out in spring of 2005, partly because it was getting a bit dicey, dangerous, and also the number of places you could actually visit as a foreigner, as a journalist, were very limited. You couldn't go to West Baghdad because it was too dangerous around Abu Ghraib. You couldn't go to the northern areas. You couldn't go to the east around Sadr City because of the threats from the Shia militias. You had different groups everywhere. By 2006, that had got even worse. And that year, a friend of mine, a girl called Jill Carroll, was kidnapped by a group of Al-Qaeda militiamen and held for about 3 months. So that kind of gives you an idea of the level of risk you were running if you stayed as a reporter in Baghdad. I was also a freelancer as well, so I wasn't part of one of those New York Times teams that would have security guards and armored cars and a large staff to kind of keep an eye out for them, which was what a lot of the better resourced media teams had at that point, and justifiably so. The sheer levels of danger that pretty much every media faced, and the lack of access, meant that by mid 2006, actually, there was the Iraq was not getting the coverage that it should do. And certainly the period that you were just talking about there, mid-2006, I think was about the absolute, you know, the absolute low point where you had the Sunni-Shia civil war at its height, and you know, people getting killed in the streets, death squads wandering around everywhere. When you look back at that time, it was horrific. And yet it wasn't getting that much coverage at home. I think partly just because it was very, very difficult for any journalist to actually cover it. And also, frankly, I don't think it was something that people really wanted to shout about. There wasn't much, the American public and the American military. This was not something a story that was very attractive to anybody. But Iraq was really plunging in, you know, into the depths of despair at that point. I'm sure you probably remember it very well.
I do. And that's another reason I really wanted to have you on the show too, is because the importance of journalism and history and documenting what is going on in the world, it's critical. Journalists provide a critical snapshot of our history. And if we don't have someone out there documenting it, you're either going to get a skewed viewpoint, or you're going to get a viewpoint from one party or not the other party, as far as, like, you know, the militants, the terrorists, or anything else out there, or you're going to have it from the military, who's going to provide different types of views. I like having journalists out there who are going to step into the arena, so to say, and see what's going on and document the facts. And that's the kind of journalism that I'm very supportive of.
Well, yeah, I mean, I must say, back in that period, I went back to Baghdad, I think, for the first time, just kind of traveling around the streets of Baghdad in 2007. And by that time, I was on staff at the Telegraph by then. We had the budget to afford an armored car and armed guards and all that sort of thing. Even then, though, it was difficult. And we spent time embedded with US military units were involved in the troop surge, which I think many of your listeners will probably remember, those who've served in Iraq. And that at that time was a real last throw of the dice by the US military to just throw extra resources at a problem that seemed hopeless at the time, this burgeoning civil war. And there was a lot of people, military and otherwise, who thought it was a bad idea. It was a gamble, but it did pay off. I remember doing some very memorable embeds with US Army units on the ground who were doing the surge, risking their lives a lot of the time. It was one of the most difficult embeds I've ever done in terms of the risk. And yet they managed to turn Iraq, you know, they managed to put a stop to that civil war. I'm not saying it was perfect, but my sense is that Iraq managed to kind of go on a relatively level plane after that, thanks to the the Sahwa, the Sunni awakening that the Americans managed to organize, which again, a lot of your listeners will probably remember. And I'm not entirely sure that the US military gets all the credit for that, that it perhaps deserves in some quarters. But if anybody who had seen or was aware of the depths to which Iraq was going at that point in the previous year in 06 would realize that, you know, even getting the murder rate down to, you know, 1,000 a month doesn't sound great, but when it was 3,000 a month before, that's, you know, that's a result. And Iraq had some relatively peaceful years after that.
They did. And that's the concept that nobody really understands. And you and I were talking a little bit before we started recording about becoming a snapshot, becoming a soundbite. A lot of the U.S. media is soundbites. You know, you could show a troop buildup back in 06 or 07, and it's going to be on air for 3 or 4 minutes, and they're going to move on to the next story. But unless you actually document it and actually look at the metrics and read it, a lot of times people need to read it to understand it. You don't get like a really good perception of what's going on.
That makes sense. News media tends to be history written by amnesiacs, you know, people who just forget what happened last year or the year before. And, you know, if you follow the news, it's not hard to document the ups and downs. You didn't have to go to Baghdad like I did to be able to find out what was going on to some extent in Iraq. But it does require people who follow a particular story through the ebbs and flows to sometimes really see that bigger picture and say, well, like, okay, Iraq right now isn't great, but Christ, it's a lot better than it was 3 years ago or 5 years ago. And that's when you can also sort of say, look, you know, hold off on dishing out blame here or on dishing out credit, because you need to see where the graph was, earlier on in the decade or whether to really see where the long-term path is.
Now you're always in hot zones. You know, I'm looking at your career. You head to Africa, Somalian pirates. That, man, talk about just going from Iraq. You're in Somalia now. How did that come about? You're like, I think I'll go do a story and another one of the most dangerous aspects of the world back then.
Well, yeah, to refresh your listeners' minds, for those who don't remember the Somali piracy crisis, basically just first a quick little bit of potted history. Somalia, after 1991, went through a very devastating civil war with a failed UN intervention that led to incidents like Black Hawk Down in Mogadishu. After Black Hawk Down, the US pulled out of Somalia, the country basically went into meltdown. It had no government really for the next 2 decades. And in a country where you've got no government, you have no law, and that allows militias and lawlessness to thrive. And what happened in Somalia really was that you used to have a lot of passing fishing boats coming in, foreign fishing vessels coming in and stealing the country's fish, just poaching it because the waters were unpoliced. Some of the local Somali fishermen, these guys, basically just artisans who also had access to weaponry, decided they didn't really like that, and they started forming their own kind of Robin Hood vigilante patrols, dishing out punishments to any passing fishing vessels that they caught stealing their fish. That at least was the roots of this. There's a bit of a folk myth around it, though, to be honest. I think that probably happened a few times. But once word got around that there were vigilante groups going around robbing passing fishing vessels, it didn't take long for other militiamen to kind of realize, hey, you know, we can go around just robbing any old fishing vessel or any old cargo vessel, indeed, and say that we're doing it in the name of, protecting our waters. And from there, you got this situation of growing Somali piracy. It went from vigilantism to outright piracy. And it was the biggest outbreak of piracy we've seen, really, on the Seven Seas since the golden era of piracy in the Elizabethan times, you know, when you had kind of Blackbeard and people like that sailing around the Caribbean. There was a difference, though. The Somali pirates didn't steal the ship's cargo like pirates would do of old, you know, because if you're boarding a big kind of container vessel containing 100,000 tons of cement, that's kind of hard to get rid of, especially if it's stolen. It's hard to transport. How many people do you know want to buy 100,000 tons of stolen cement? So what they would do instead, they would take the crew hostage and they would use them. They would try and extract ransoms for them. And the other advantage they had was that all they would have to do was sail the ship, the hijacked ship, just off the Somali coastline. And then if anyone tried to intervene, say the US military or anyone else, they could just take the pirates could just whisk the hostages onto the mainland and hide them out somewhere. The US military nor any other military would want to go anywhere near the Somali mainland. It was just considered too dangerous and out of jurisdiction. So effectively, you had a kind of safe haven for the pirates. This then kind of began to escalate around 2008. The pirates got ambitious and they got good. And at one, they started stealing, you know, hijacking more and more ships. And at one point in late 2008, they hijacked a big oil tanker, a big Saudi oil tanker, worth about $100 million plus about $150 million worth of oil on it. And at that point, the world kind of realized, hang on, you know, these guys are now threatening our strategic oil supplies. This is a strategic threat. This is not just a bunch of guys hijacking the odd dodgy fishing trawler that shouldn't have been there in the first place. And at that point, my boss said, listen, can you go to Somalia and see if you can do a bit of reporting on the ground about how these pirates operate and what local people feel about them? So because I'd been to Somalia once before on a previous trip 2 years before, that counted me as the office expert on Somalia. Not exactly an expert, but better than not having been there at all. So off we went, myself and a photographer. And the idea really was just to get a bit of a flavor of a bit of color from the ground. We weren't obviously expecting to go to a pirate haven or anything like that and meet these guys face to face, because, you know, they're basically professional hostage takers, and it was fairly obvious what the consequences of that might be. However, we did hope that we'd be able to get a bit of color, find out what local people thought about the pirates and so on and so forth. So off we went, and we flew to a town in northern Somalia called Bosaso. It's a very poor city, not much employment, anything like that. Also pretty lawless, not just piracy going on there. There's weapons trafficking, drug trafficking, people trafficking, all kinds of maritime crime. The other problem, if you're a foreigner there, is that Bosaso has, and most of that coastline, the kidnapping culture that the piracy brought also spread onto the land. So if you're there as a foreigner and a Westerner like me, it's, you know, you've got a target on your head. So to ward that off, what you do is you hire local bodyguards. These are not like ex-Navy SEALs or Delta guys or anything like that. These are usually friends or cousins of your translator, often people from his clan. You get about six or seven of them, guys with AK-47s. Will they lay their life down for you? No, but it's better than nothing. And it's also generating income for a particular clan. So if anybody kidnaps you, then they're depriving that clan of their income, and that might not be such a good idea. So it makes people think twice. So we thought, anyway, we had about a week in Bosaso, got our story done, more or less, headed back to the airport, where in one pickup truck, the bodyguards are in another. And then they decided to kidnap us themselves, the very people we had paid to keep us safe. Their car suddenly shot in front of ours. They pulled up, brandished their guns, and cut a long story short, they pulled us out of our pickup truck, my photographer Jose and myself, and stuck us in their pickup truck. And at that, there was a few seconds where I was thinking, you know, I don't speak Somali. Maybe there's just a bit of a mix-up as to what truck we're using or something like that. And then when they pointed their gun in my face, it became very clear that we were getting kidnapped, which was a sort of oh shit moment to say the very least.
Oh shit! I can't imagine that one. I mean, seriously. I mean, you two. It's not like you're the U.S. government or the UK government where you have, hey, you know what? We're going to send all the resources. They got one of our diplomats. They got one of our soldiers. They got this. They got that. You're a reporter. I mean, what happens next? Do they say, hey, call up your editor, call up your boss and get us some money?
Well, basically, yeah. So what they did was they drove us off into the mountains and they route marched us for 2 days at gunpoint across this very remote mountain range. If any of your listeners have ever been to the remoter regions of Afghanistan, you'll know what I mean, a place where you just don't see another living soul for, you know, at all. You don't even see any footpaths, any signs of habitation. And throughout all that, I was thinking like, well, you know, this is not like Iraq or Afghanistan, actually. We don't have a coalition presence here or anything like that. There's no groups of special forces waiting to come in and get us out. We might as well have been abducted to another planet in terms of how anyone's going to come and help us. You know, the nearest UK embassy is in Kenya. That's 1,500 miles away. So, yeah, you felt very much beyond reach. The gang did make it fairly clear early on that they wanted money for us, which was not great, but it was better, I suppose, than being told that this was some kind of political kidnapping and that these were jihadists. Somalia has a big jihadist faction, Al-Shabaab, who are affiliated to Al-Qaeda. And we were worried to start off with that might have been who had taken us. And you could see a situation where they would issue some kind of unreasonable demand, like, you know, pulling, you know, all US troops out of Muslim countries or anything like that. And something that they knew we would, the US would never concede to, and that we would end up getting beheaded. Luckily, that didn't seem like the situation at the time. They demanded $3 million for us. My office refused to pay. And they said, look, you know, these are journalists. They are visiting Somalia as, you know, to try and highlight the problems the country's facing. The usual spiel, frankly. I'm not sure anybody bought that. But the idea was to bring pressure to bear on local clan leaders and politicians and so on to say, look, if this kind of thing keeps happening, then no foreigners, be they journalists or perhaps more pertinently aid workers or business people, are going to want to come either. And that's not going to be good for Somalia's future reputation.
So you're there for weeks. How long were you like? Yeah. Let's talk about that. What is it like to be in captivity for that long and just never knowing?
Well, we were stuck in we were held in caves, a series of caves in this remote mountain range for the next 6 weeks. Yeah. By Somali standards, kidnapping standards, that's not actually that long. A lot of other kidnappings on the land of people, foreigners, typical turnaround time, maybe 6 months, maybe. I know people have been held there for 3 years. Which is, so ours in a sense was a kind of kidnap light, you could almost say, but it didn't feel like that at the time, no. The first couple of weeks were okay. My fellow hostage and I, we sort of bonded in captivity quite well. We spent the time chatting a lot about our past lives. The first couple of weeks, when you get kidnapped, it feels a bit like being in a kind of a waiting room before the afterlife. Like, you know, you feel like your fate is hanging in the balance. You don't know which direction you're going to go. And you feel in a mood for sort of talking about your life to whoever you've been kidnapped with, if you're lucky enough to be kidnapped with somebody else and have someone to talk to. And so you kind of unburden yourself. You talk about, you know, everything under the sun. And that keeps the time, you know, that helps the time pass and also keeps your morale up. You find funny things to laugh at. You get this sort of strange heightened sense of the absurd. But after a couple of weeks, you know, you begin, like any, you know, when you have a weekend away with your other half, for example, you often find, like, you know, there's lapses in the conversation when you get a bit, God, you know, and that kicked in after 2 or 3 weeks. We began to find it hard to make conversation. It would be an effort a lot of the time to do so. We used to do it just on point of principle, and you could maybe sort of pass an hour or some doing that. But and that's where it starts getting scary, because the more time you spend not talking or doing anything, the slower time passes. A minute seems like an hour seems like a day, so on and so forth. And that's when you begin to think, you know, what's this doing to my mental health? I got to the point where I found it was beginning to get hard even just to pass the time by daydreaming. And that's kind of where you sort of think, look, you know, if this goes on for months and months, I'm not sure how easy I'm going to be able to cope. It's, that is much harder. The boredom is a far harder prospect than just, say, like having crappy food or uncomfortable conditions.
How did this all end?
Well, we were able to keep contact with our office. The pirates were pretty efficient, actually. At within about 5 days, they made us they produced a mobile phone, took us up to the top of a mountain where we could get a phone reception, and made us call our office. And they made us issue this demand for $3 million for me and $3 million for my my fellow hostage, Jose. And from then on, there was sort of ongoing, every few days, proof of life phone calls home. And we were aware of some efforts at negotiations. We didn't know, to this day, I don't really know what those negotiations were that brought about our release. As I said, money was asked. As I also said, though, the office said, look, we don't want to pay money. We want these guys released. And they tried to bring diplomatic pressure. I'm not sure what the clinching factor was, but 6 weeks in, after a few false starts and after one very last day right towards the end where they said, there's a deal to free you, and then they changed their mind and said, nope, the deal is off. You're going to stay here for another year. Luckily, a few hours later, they said, no, we're back. You know, it's back to square one again. We're back on track to get you released. And we were duly handed over to a group of clan intermediaries on about day 41, I think it was. And that's always a kind of, we were told, we had a phone call from the office saying, look, here's the choreography of the handover is going to be like this. You will get taken tomorrow morning to a spot in the mountains, a rendezvous point where you will meet a group of clan intermediaries, clan elders, who are trusted by the pirates and also trusted by our side. Not sure what someone does to be trusted by both sides in these situations, but that's the way these things work. And you will be handed over to them if all goes well. And then you'll be driven back to Basaso, the town where you were first picked up, kidnapped, and a plane will come and pick you up. Okay, fine. But it's always a nerve-wracking moment, because in any kidnap, the handover is the moment when the gang have to show themselves, and also they have to hand over the goods. So they're nervous. They're worried that they're going to get ripped off in some way. You know, that they might not get the money or whatever concession it is that they wanted. They're worried that it's going to be a police trap, possibly. So it's a bit like being in a major league drug deal, and you are the contraband, basically. Mm-hmm. And everyone's trigger happy. If you've ever seen Scarface, that bit where the coke deal all goes horribly wrong, mm-hmm. That's a bit like how you feel. And sure enough, the day we were due to be handed over, we were woken at dawn. And a small army basically assembled. It wasn't just the dozen odd kidnappers that were regularly guarding us, but there was about 50 of their mates there as well. with rocket propelled grenades, technicals, you know, like SUVs with heavy machine guns mounted on them, so on and so forth. So they were clearly worried about trouble. They drove us up the top of a mountain pass, and down at the bottom we could see a few other SUVs where the clan elders were. They said, right, you guys walk down there with your hands held up. Don't do anything stupid. We'll be right behind you. They were, sure enough. And we wandered down expecting things to go wrong at any minute. But luckily they didn't. We were handed over to this clan elder, an elderly kind of grandpa-aged guy in a suit. And he said, congratulations, you are free. And I think I said, okay, great. Do you have a smoke by any chance? And that was it. We were basically whisked off at high speed back to Bosaso, stuck on a plane, and were safely in Kenya a few hours later.
Talk about a sense of relief when you touch back down at home, right? And then you're like, oh, whew.
Yeah. We were told on the way back that one of the guys who picked us up on the plane from Bosaso was a sort of ex-military guy who had worked in Africa doing these kind of situations a lot. He was there basically just to ensure that everything went smoothly. Very nice fellow. I owe him a lot. He said to us, look, on the plane back, he said, look, you know, you will get a kind of delayed shock reaction of some sort. You've had a lot of adrenaline going. You may kind of crash down to earth at some point and suddenly get depressed or upset or anxious or what have you. So I braced myself for that. But to be honest, it never happened. I was just really, really glad to be out of there and really, really happy just to be home and to be free. It was like being born again. And I did worry about a crash at some point, but it never happened.
Well, it's been a long time, so hopefully it doesn't. You never know. It's going to happen. You know, we got to watch out for that stuff. Because like a lot of people don't understand that. They always equate like post-traumatic stress and everything to military and law enforcement, but civilians also get it. And it can, you know, it's like, that's what I was going to ask you about that is like about like, you know, how did you deal with that trauma?
I didn't get any PTSD at all. I put that down to a few reasons. One was just, you know, we weren't held that long. We weren't mistreated, we weren't tortured or hurt in any way. I didn't get any PTSD. I put that down to a number of reasons. First of all, we weren't held that long and we weren't mistreated that badly while we were in captivity, we weren't tortured or anything. They threatened to do that a few times, which is bad enough, I can tell you. But generally, we emerged physically unscathed. Also, as a journalist, or indeed perhaps as a soldier or an aid worker or anybody like that, you're kind of signing up for a deal when you do a job like that. That you sort of say, "Hey, I want to see the world. I want to know what you know the kind of the other side of life is like."
Now, did this perspective you had as a hostage, is that the reason you wrote the book Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea?
I think the reasons I didn't get PTSD, well, one is that we were only held for 6 weeks, which is not actually that long. Another is that we were not physically harmed while we were in captivity, although they did threaten to torture us a few times, which is bad enough. A third, though, is that, you know, if you're a foreign affairs journalist or indeed a soldier or a law enforcement officer, I think you sign up for it partly to sort of see the kind of wilder, edgier sides of life to some extent. And, you know, kidnapping is an insight into that. So you can put it down to sort of being one of life's valid, you know, experiences, not a pleasant one, but a valid one nonetheless. If I had been, say, just a regular sort of, you know, office worker or something on holiday in the Caribbean and something like that happened to me as a, you know, I was kidnapped, you might think, hey, I didn't sign up for this. This is not part of my life that I want. Then it might be harder to deal with. But to anyone out who's been through a similar thing and is wondering, he still finds it hard to wonder, you know, to figure out why I didn't get PTSD. I think one of the other things is, there was no sort of issues about whether we could have done something to avoid it happening or any kind of if onlys or what ifs sort of thing. Some of the people I know who've had kidnap experiences I found it harder to get over because, somebody got killed during the abduction, or they felt it was their fault in some way or something like that. At the end of the day, you know, none of that sort of thing happened in mine, and therefore it was possible for us to come out the other side and laugh and joke about it. Whereas if people have got hurt or killed somewhere in the process, whether it's, you know, the innocent parties or even the kidnappers, then I think it's harder to kind of make light of it, and that makes it harder to move on, you know.
Now, you went on to write that Between the Devil and a Deep Blue Sea, the mission to rescue the hostages the world forgot. Now, that your passion for, you know, the hostage situation in Somalia probably stemmed from your own captivity, I would imagine.
Yes, it did. So after being in captivity myself, I wrote a book about my own hostage experience. And I kept pretty close tabs on what was happening with the Somali piracy crisis generally. And it petered out by about 2012, after about 4 good years for the pirates anyway. Ships just began to take the view, like, we need to protect ourselves. And they started posting armed guards, mainly ex-US and British military people on board. And that pretty much nipped the problem in the bud. However, there were a few ships that spent a lot, I noticed while kind of keeping tabs on this, that seemed to be hijacked for a great deal longer than any others. Three particular ships that were hijacked for 3 years, 4 years, and 5 years apiece. And I remember thinking, you know, why are these ships never getting released? Most ships get released after, you know, 3 months, 6 months, a ransom gets paid, and that's that. But bad enough, but at least the sailors get to go home. In these cases, that was not happening. Nobody really knew what was going on board these ships. But it transpired that the owners of the ships did not have any money to pay the ransoms demanded by the hijackers, either because they were in financial trouble because of the recession that was biting at that time in 2010 or so, or because they didn't have any kidnap and ransom insurance, which is true of a lot of vessels from the developing world. These were ships owned by, you know, companies in the Middle East and the Far East, as a result, the hostages, the sailors, were stuck there. I think the owners' gamble was that after a while, the pirates would get tired of holding the hostages for no ransom and would just release them for free. However, Somali pirates don't do that. They come from a country that's very poor, and they're not going to lightly give up the prize of a ransom of $1 million or $2 million. And also, that they've invested money in the thing themselves. If you look after a bunch of guys, a bunch of hostages, for a year or two, you're already paying a group of guards, maybe 10 guards, $20 a day each, even $5 a day each. You do the maths over 1,000 days or, you know, sort of several hundred days, that money begins to add up. Mm-hmm. So the pirate gangs were saying, well, look, even if we wanted to, we would not be able to release these guys because we've run up thousands of dollars in debts that we need to pay off. And they owe that money to other pirate clans. They're not the kind of guys who are going to, you know, just go away. And so in order to increase the pressure on the owners, the pirates started torturing the crews. So they're not just stuck there for years on end, but they're also getting tortured. All kinds of awful things, like kind of medieval piracy stuff, being left out on the deck for days on end in the boiling tropical sun, being just beaten to within an inch of their lives, having their fingers pulled up with pliers, being scalded, being stuck in the put in the ship's deep freeze, naked for 45 minutes, being dipped over the side, trussed up and dipped headfirst into the water, like the sort of stuff that you used to read in pirate storybooks, and think, thank God that kind of thing never happens anymore. So there these guys were. They were. This was happening all the time. They were also being put on starvation diets. And of the 50 guys or so that were on these three ships, one was executed in cold blood. About eight died from starvation, just from diseases brought on by malnutrition. And the rest were, you know, tortured to within an inch of their lives. And nobody was doing anything about it. And some of your listeners at this point are probably thinking, right, okay, well, like the owners aren't paying up. That's not cool, but there you go. What about all the big anti-piracy fleet that we had at that time with American, British vessels, Russian vessels, you know, pretty much everyone around the world, all with special forces crews on, as some of your listeners will remember from the film Captain Phillips, where you get a bunch of sharpshooters take out the pirates. And unfortunately, special forces crews on British or American ships will not get involved in rescues for third country nationals, not unless one of their own members or one of their own citizens is present on the vessel. There's two reasons for that. One is the risk of injury or death to the special forces crews. And then there's also just rescue operations, force rescue operations tend to be very, very high risk. And no one wants to risk injury to the soldiers or indeed to the civilians for anybody other than their own citizens. That's just one of those unfortunate facts of life. So nobody was coming to get these guys. As time went on, nobody even knew where they were. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that these guys would still be there now or would have just died in captivity had it not been for the efforts of a British diplomat, a guy called John Steed, who was a former British diplomat based in Kenya, which neighbours Somalia. He was the military attaché officially. And so he had quite a lot of involvement in the in counter piracy stuff, it tried to equip the Somali government with some kind of naval force, for example. And he kept close tabs on what was going on, like I did, and realized these ships, these three hostage hijacked ships, were stuck with no one, nowhere to go, and. Because he also worked for the UN in latter years as well as a sort of counter-piracy advisor, he undertook this mission to try and get them freed, realizing basically that if he didn't do it, nobody else would. And his first idea was that if he could establish some kind of humanitarian rapport with the pirates, he could at least find out how many of the crew were still alive and then hope to get some aid packages through to them, humanitarian aid. And that after a while, once some relationship, some rapport was built with the pirate gangs, basically just say to them, look, guys, unfortunately, you picked the wrong wrong ships to hijack here. These owners don't have any money. These are poor seafarers from the poorer parts of Asia, that they're not much wealthier than you are. Please let them go. He thought that would work. But at that point, the pirates said, when he established contact with them, well, sorry, but we've got debts. We are hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt to our fellow pirate clans. And at that point, John Steed realized, having gone down gone that far, that he was going to have to raise the ransom money himself. And again, you think, well, maybe there's a short answer to the story here. He goes to some billionaire philanthropist, a kind of Elon Musk type.
Yeah.
And the guy, right, Musk says, sure, right, here's a check for, tell me how much it's going to be. Just assure me that this is for good purposes. Okay, you're a British Army officer. I trust you. Writes a check for a couple of million and everyone's free and they go home. Doesn't work like that. philanthropists are very wary of paying out money for ransoms. For a start, in the United States, there are all kinds of laws against it. And also, it doesn't really look good for your average philanthropist on his kind of list of great deeds that he's done that year. Hey, I gave a bunch of money to a bunch of Somali criminals. So, that option was not available. It took John several years to raise the money, during which he was involved in a kind of race against time to, you know, knowing that the pirates, you know, the conditions of these hostages was getting worse and worse. And it just generally made it a very, very, a much tougher mission than it should have been. But basically stuck with it. And after the best part of 3 years, he managed to raise the money for all three ships individually and get the hostages freed. Which is a pretty impressive achievement. Yeah.
I can't get over 3 years.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that was one of the reasons I wrote the book. I thought, like, well, 6 weeks in pirate captivity, I was going up the wall and I wasn't being tortured. Mm-hmm. What is it like stuck there for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years when you're getting tortured, when your friends are dying around you, and when you know also that there doesn't seem to be anybody who's coming to rescue you? It's, it is just a suffering of a completely different league.
Has me thinking now. It's like 3 years incarcerated, being tortured. Someone's like being POWs, except you didn't, like you said before, you didn't sign up for this type of stuff. These are crew members. Yeah.
These are ordinary guys. These are seafarers from places like Thailand, from Cambodia, from India, Sri Lanka. They're not doing the job, you know, what's the old saying? Become a merchant sailor and see the world. Mm-hmm. Most of these guys have been this just to feed their families. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're poor guys. Often previous generations are tilling the fields and, so, you know, paddy fields, peasant farmers in places like India. These are not wealthy guys. And they did not sign up for this kind of thing at all. Again, a lot of your listeners will be thinking, like, if they were kidnapped or taken POW while serving with the US military abroad, they would know that they would be a high priority and that there would be efforts to get them back, even if it came down to swapping them in and out for Taliban prisoners or something like that. They know that, you know, their country had their back. And that wasn't something that these folk had to come for them.
You know, at this point, you've seen a lot already. You know, you've been a journalist for decades plus, starting in the 90s. Now, let's flash forward to here, Ukraine this year. You're there. You've been there.
Yeah.
What is it like on the ground?
Well, it's interesting. It depends on where you are. If you're in somewhere like Kiev at the moment, if you watch the TV news, it looks terrifying. You see bombs landing on the, you know, it's destroying tower blocks. And you hear stories of drones buzzing overhead and so on and so forth. I was there pretty much right at the beginning. I was in the West when the war started. I'd flown in the night before expecting it to all be kind of fairly, you know, to sort of fizzle out, basically. Then all hell broke loose. And then I think about 5 days into the war, I had to get to Kiev to take over from a colleague who was pulling out. He'd been there for a month already. By that point, everybody was fleeing from Kiev. The roads were jammed. It was impossible to find a driver who would be willing to take me to Kiev. You didn't know what was on the roads, what roads might suddenly have Russians popping up on them. Remarkably, though, the train service was still running. So I got a train into Kiev. And at that point, the city felt very, very empty. The streets were pretty much deserted. Air raid sirens going off all the time. It felt pretty spooky, like World War III was about to erupt. And yet, as time went on, you realized that actually, even when the city was under siege, imagine being in New York and you've got one or two districts where there's fighting and then some missiles raining in here and there, a few a day. As long as you stay out of those districts, and as long as you're not unlucky enough to be one of those two or three missiles that comes in per day, is which is a kind of lightning strikes thing, you're relatively okay. You know, it's not pleasant, but it's a kind of manageable deal. It's not like the kind of thing you saw with, say, shock and awe in Baghdad in 2003, where you literally see every kind of major building getting taken out left, right, and center behind you. So it was surprisingly manageable, actually. Although there was the impression you got. That was how I felt after sort of a couple of weeks there. You began to kind of get a handle on it. Right at the beginning, it wasn't like that. Right at the beginning, you felt like, you know, hang on, this is not Iraq or Afghanistan or some war in Africa. This is Uncle Vladimir Putin and his army. This is the world's second superpower. These guys could be landing anywhere at any time, even in Lviv. I was thinking, what happens if they seal the border? What happens if Russian paratroopers blow up all the roads from Lviv? What if teams of Russian undercover saboteurs suddenly emerge on the streets of Lviv in the West and start killing people at random and targeting people like me just to cause trouble and strife, which was sort of what people were expecting, all kinds of asymmetric shit coming down. And yeah, it was scary. Never mind the fact that you also had nuclear weapons as well. It just, I've never covered a war where you felt like you were on the weaker side against a much bigger malign power. You know, not only is Russia militarily superior to Ukraine, you also felt like these were people who would not be playing by the rules of war very much either. So there was every reason to feel scared. But then as time went on, it became apparent that they weren't going to take Kiev in a matter of 72 hours. Then everyone said, oh, it'll be a week. Then it was like 3 weeks. And then it was like, oh, actually, they're not going to take Kiev at all. And by the end of the month, just before I pulled out for my first stint, I've done three there, there was already talk of the Russians leaving. So, it was an interesting lesson in the fact that even a major power like Russia is, they're not omnipotent in the way that we perhaps expect, certainly when it comes to conventional warfare.
You know, I kind of wanted, you know, if for someone like me, who's, I'm going to be out of law enforcement, been doing investigations for years, journalism kind of seems like a natural fit, investigative journalism, for, you know, people who have done investigations in the past. Because it's kind of cool. You're pulling facts together. How do you get into journalism? I mean, what was your push? Like, you know, let's go back to the Wayback Machine. And, you know, you and I probably took the different paths in the 90s. I went into military. You went into journalism. What took your path into that world?
Well, I became a journalist in 1994, mainly because I couldn't really think of anything else that would interest me. And I thought, well, journalism's going to be doing something different every day, rather than sort of doing banking or law or what have you, you know, the civil service. And that's certainly true. But I started off the old school way. I started on a local newspaper in the north of England, doing the kind of stories that you do on local papers, court stories, human interest stories, planning meetings, which I think you call zoning meetings in the United States, all the kind of usual humdrum stuff of small town life. And yet it is the world in microcosm. Individually, a lot of those stories might not be that exciting, but collectively you're getting an amazing kind of window into how society works and also how it all connects up, you know. And you get out the office a lot, and you cover those stories firsthand. You're not doing them remotely. You go to that courtroom, you sit in that court, you see the defendants, you speak to the lawyers, etc., etc. You speak to the victims. You do all these things firsthand. It's a lot of actual shoe leather reporting. Whereas if you, you know, if you in a big newspaper in somewhere like London or say the New York Times, sometimes you'll get to go out and about, but quite often you're sat in, you know, at HQ writing about the events hundreds of miles away, not enough time to go and see it firsthand. Which is why I would always say to people, do some small town reporting first. It's no different to being, I often think it's similar to being a police officer. You start out on the beat, often in a small town or something like that, and you learn the trade slowly. And then you kind of gradually move up the ranks. But there's a fashion these days for taking on interns and so on. At national newspaper level, whether it's the Washington Post or the Daily Telegraph in my country, the big national papers, and you go straight out of college and you join the nationals. But I still think it's worth doing those early years in the, you know, in the provinces, in the local areas where you really learn the trade properly. And you really see what it's like. And certainly within the profession, there's a certain respect for anyone who's kind of done the local paper route, even if it doesn't mark you out as the kind of high flyer who, you know, got a job straight away on the WashPo or wherever.
You see, there is, I still think there's a very big, and I think you'd agree, there's a big duality between being a special agent, being an investigator. Let's say when I used to work in the field, I would have to develop sources, I'd have to gather information, and I had to put it into a report. And to me, it's got to be factual. You know, it's not going to be like, okay, making up some stuff. In the same way with journalism, and that's what I really like about the journalists. That's what I like about investigative journalists. That's what I like about people who are out there digging into the stories and bringing stories to light. I mean, who would have brought up the, you know, wrote a book or wrote stories about Somali pirates unless they went out there and got the information? You can't get that kind of stuff from a keyboard 2,000 miles away and get the real ground truth.
Yeah, it's true. And also, I do think there's a sense of curiosity and finding out about how the world works, and being interested in what life is like for the people who are not so lucky in the world, who live on the kind of wilder, more lawless fringes. You know, I'm a kind of pretty regular middle class individual. I didn't grow up around that, so I have a curiosity to see what life is like outside my own kind of comfortable little bubble, whether it's in my own country or elsewhere. I think that motivates a lot of law enforcement officers as well. They have other motivations too, to right wrongs and generally protect people. And I would also say law enforcement is tougher because when you're trying to unravel stories, you've got people who are going to be much, much more actively conniving not to tell you the truth. And it matters more. If somebody doesn't, you know, tells me a few lies in the story, well, you know, maybe it's the kind of story where I maybe let them off the hook a bit, or we never got it published. Whereas with law enforcement, you know, that can mean the difference between somebody going to prison for a crime and getting away with it, or indeed being wrongly convicted of a crime, you know, or whatever. So it's a much bigger challenge what you do. But it is no surprise that there's always been a kind of close relationship between journalists and the police. The journalists see police officers as one of their primary sources of news, definitely. Although increasingly, unfortunately, certainly in my country, the days of informal contact between journalists and police are pretty much over these days. It's all, you know, you've got to call our public affairs bureau and everything else. Which is a shame because public affairs bureaus in every walk of life always have a certain interest in creating a kind of, you know, avoiding an unspun version of events. But that's just in the modern world, sadly.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, Colin. There's a lot I can learn from you, and I look forward to keeping in contact. And I appreciate being a guest on the show.
Not at all. It's been great. Thank you for having me on.